do spread the gar. I did have some notes to tell you all about his career and everything, but you came here to hear him, not me. So I think, in view of the late start, I'll simply pass it over to you.
Oh, sorry to keep you waiting. It's rude. I'm sure you don't want to watch me drink water, but I'm thirsty. I was going to read from Bill of Rights, but I can't find it. At this point, someone in the audience says, "I have a copy." That's if you're a writer who sells. If you're one who doesn't, there's an uncanny silence. No one has got a copy of Bill of Rights. Thank you. Oh, God. A round of applause for that. Thank you. Dip the tip of an arrow in this plant sap. Let it dry untouched in the sun. Let it fly into that wild boar. Roast the boar, but offer some to the sun. Carve buttons from the bone. Dry the skin. Tell the boar you are sorry, but you have 1,000 mouths to feed, and it fits the bill. Exactamundo. Add to these plant sap, taste of a tangerine sun, wild in the meat of that boar, roast from that aluminum sun. Buttons in those bones, eyes in those buttons you tell sorry, 1,000 mouths you have to feed, 1,000 grins feeding you. Bill, that boar fits exactly. Bow tie, bodacious father, muddle divine daddy, friend of Lenin, friend of Amin, friend of Stalin. Here the trades rinse the air constantly. Rain returns the verdant to grass, trees, and palin. All the days of my life ever since I've been born, I never heard a man speak like this man before. 1,000 Tarzan yodels tear the night to ribbons. Night flutters in the breeze and shreds. Cries strike the dark with the spark of fireflies. To wave a mosquito from the forehead takes more effort than to clear this forest. Clear this continent of all of its wood. Burn that wood into smoke, into cloud. Spread that cloud over the entire planet. Sink our planet into a black hole. Send that hole spinning into unknown space. Holy is coconut with cream and water. Holy stinking toe, and sour sap, and Edo. Holy this vision in him that brought us here. Holy his name Jones, and his every aspect. Holy am I for my proximity to him. Holy this Uzi blessed in service to him. Holy every drop that rains and rusts our joints. Holy the hardwood green art in our huts. Holy him, holy me, holy you, holy this, holy that, holy the deterrent, holy the serpent of temptation, holy Pontius Pilate, holy Judas Iscariot, holy the sun uncut through rain, holy the Baku, Jambi, Old Haig, holy that giant pearl elasticated on water, holy water gyrating underneath that weightless jewel. Autochthonous wood, purple heart and green heart, blunted or broke electric saw after electric saw in half. Wood this tough cannot have known much love, and must have hardened itself against further loss of face. Yuk Napatawpha County, this was not. Rice for water, rice water soup for lunch. Yes, there was time for lunch. Rice and beans for dinner with the stubborn giant anteater, the sloth and the caiman, too tough by far, even for our meager pots. In this dream, there's no word for rice, no picture for rice, no taste for rice, no smell for rice, no touch, no sound, no imagining rice. Flint flicked into flames. Two sticks, a green heart or a purple heart, rub together until they catch. Our matches are moist and useless. Kerosene wicks drown in the mist. The vines are flame-shaped, cold and green as moss. Leaves leap, curl, crawl as if out of control. Their razored edges cut and burn. Razor grass moon, flint stick sun, needling rain, obia moon, witching sun, stone rain, laser sun. What came to pass has come to pass, has come and gone, came and went. What came to pass that has not always passed, always came and passed, what comes must pass. What came to pass came and did not pass, did come, did pass, had come, had passed. What came to pass came to stay with us, came in fact for us, came and we passed. There is a relevant passage in the Good Book for this season of pestilential rain, for our crops that refuse to grip hills, for the mosquito that sings as it sucks us dry, for water snakes, manatees, and marabuntas, for the hours when we huddle for warmth, for nothing, no thing catches to make fire, for our God who preaches silence, who by example starves and falls into a fit. That relevant passage slips my mind, slips from the Good Book, from this rainforest, this wet world, from this moment referred to as that slippery passage, that irrelevant book, that not-so-good book, that so-so book, that kiss-me-ass book, that rain, rain that never fucks off, that world beyond this arsehole forest. I was there when Jim Jones cracked his one and only joke. He called Guyana's bracken-tumbling savannas blasted flat-assed country. Such exaggerated ceaseless laughter as there was, the likes of which had never been heard before or since in those jungle confines, curbed only when Jones, failing with his hand held high in repeated dismissive waves, suddenly lost his temper, pulled off his belt, and beat everyone within reach, ignoring his trousers around his feet. I can testify the man never wore any skids or underpants. Swing low, sweet chariot. Savannah, raced by bundles of bracken, raced by the uninterrupted wind, raced in turn by someone equal in stature to the reverend. God is in his heaven. The people's temple know him as a statue that comes to life with the wave of a wand in the form of our Jim that can't be broken. As the savannah races towards the forest retreats towards the river. As the river reaches for us, we plant with our backs to the trees. The savannah knows, God watches. The forest knows it too, yet the savannah advances, still the forest beats its retreat. Someone's wife is always sweeter, makes you want to grab and eat her, standing, sitting, lying down, frontwards, backwards, round and round. Someone's wife is someone's traitor, another's boss, secretary, neighbor, standing, sitting, lying down, frontwards, backwards, round and round. Dear leader, my love is true, only as true as I am to you, as you're to me, as we are to us, and to ourselves. What is this trust? What is this love? What is this fuss? Without this trust, without this love, without this fuss, there is no me, there is no you, There is no us. Only a shell, an empty well, a silent drum from here, from now, from me to you till kingdom come, a measly crumb of what we are or could have been. No hosannas, just bad manners in bandanas. No myrrh, no manna, no frankincense, and all this life a heavy load. A long sentence. Dear leader, when poetry dies, my love for you dies too. Or, put another way, my love for you can never die, not as long as there's breath in me, not as long as there's poetry for me to breathe, my love. In order for my love for you, dear leader, to die, not only must I be dead, but so must you. And not only us too, but verse too. And how can verse be dead when all there is to say about our love has not been said? Has hardly begun to be said, in fact. I take it back. Poetry is everlasting, which is to say it exists outside of time. In turn, our love as a poem outstrips time, and once time is given the slip, there is no dying. Dear leader, there is only the life of our love to live, in this case us, versus timelessness. Us two sharing this love that won't die, even as we blink in our lives and expire. Our lives no longer than a blink in time, our love no less than time, no more than life itself. Us in that love with nothing to lose if we lose our lives, since that love has slipped from time, from death, and lives as life itself. Tiger, 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 come to warm up the party. Tiger here to jive in the dance hall. Tiger going to put the tickle back in you. Tiger, bring the spice to put in your stew. Everybody want to be a tiger. Everybody afraid of the tiger. Everybody says he's friends with tiger. Everybody good to eat to the tiger. Don't cuddle a boa constrictor. Don't put your head in tiger's mouth. Don't wrestle with an alligator. Even if you have faith, procure doubt. Unbroken. Bloodlines. I had a premise. There's a man who refuses to die until he says he's going to live as long as it takes for the races to get along. As a result, he lives forever. So the book begins around the 1860s and then moves forward to the 20th century. But there are no recognizable stations of the 20th century in the book, just little bits of consciousness that might represent something happening around the person at that time. Bloodlines, of course, because it's about a mixed race heritage and about trying to reconcile twin traditions, at least two traditions. In this bit, a couple, Faith and Christy, are on the move, heading towards Maryland, along roughly the east coast of the US of A. A Quaker family is hiding them, and Faith and Christy are hiding in a room in this Quaker house. It's not really a room. It's a very small space, some furniture pushed in front of it. In this bit, you'll just hear about them being in that room, and then someone comes and moves the furniture, and they come out of the room. But it's from two different points of view. Third person, and then it launches into first person. And the speaker is Faith, and then it goes back to third person. The lover's room was not a room, more a cupboard two people can lie down in with a squeeze. Locked from outside, windowless and boarded up, with floating dust that made them sneeze louder than the heavy furniture pulled forward to block the half door they entered in on their knees. Locked in a wall, Faith and Christy listened to the affairs in the house so that the wall really did have ears. If listening in darkness is a kind of muscle, say an eyelid, as theirs surely must have been, then it relaxed slowly over those corpuscles. If listening is a skin that creeps over a fingernail unseen, that you keep pushing back to expose more cuticle, then in that musty space, eyelids and skin slid over wary eyes and fingernails as surely as dust settled on their nostrils. Their kind of sleep in that room was the equivalent of bodyguards napping while on duty. Asleep with one eyelid raised like a vent, or both eyelids raised like Venetian blinds not quite fully drawn that you can see out of but peepers can't see in. Sleep that is storks on one leg, athletes on one knee, waiting for a start that never comes. Sleep you need a rest to recover from. Yet sleep they did, something they dived towards and surfaced from both for the fall and climb. Now the children they heard in the house around them played school, spelling words, singing numbers, times tables, and nursery rhymes. Christy and Faith wanted some of those children. Faith wanted the boy, heard crying, still attached to his sister like a limb. Christy said he wanted a girl, then a boy, then a girl, and a boy, etc., more than Faith had in mind. How would their children look, they wondered. Half and half. Which half? The right half black, the left half white. No. The top half white, the bottom half African. No. I think our features will be exchanged, right? No. God would mix them properly. And then they laughed, kissed, and did what two child makers might. They were all fingers in that pitch dark, fingertips, hungry lips, as they skylarked. Our children will come out looking like little angels. They'll sing as sweet as these four children playing school and work for an honest wage because they'll be free. They talked under their breaths as oboists might arrange a tune by circular breathing. They held and held these thoughts and dozed. Fresh bread nuzzled them awake. Faith blinked herself back to her name, but couldn't remember where she was and who she shared the sweet stink of lovemaking with in this dark chamber. Then she smelled the dough baking, and it made her think to reach out and touch whoever it was next to her, just as he endeavored to touch her. Both screamed and shouted their names, laughed, hugged, and dragged on baked air. Dust thick as snuff made them sneeze volleys. Furniture groaned. Lamplight the color of butter spread evenly on their faces. They couldn't see. Their outstretched hands were taken, and muttered words seemed to melt the coins of light off of their eyes. They were led to a bucket, soap and water. After grace, they sliced the alarm clock bread and smeared yellow light on thick. Locked in the wall of that Quaker house, Christy sweet-talked me. My skin was dead, a cover for my flesh, a faded blouse worn carelessly, my bone bag and bone bed. But with you, skin is a sensation doused in oil and set ablaze, something to be read with you as my instructor, my skin as text in our skin school of gaze, touch, and reflex. Christy promised me a firstborn daughter, then a son, followed by another girl and boy. I replied between our laughing, it's all right for you to promise the world when I'll have to carry and bear them after your work is done. And what wonderful work, he yelled, rolling onto me in the dark, his legs prizing my thighs further apart. Not only you, Faith, the two of us. Whatever you do, I do. When you fall pregnant, we'll bear our children simultaneously. Yes, Christy, let's turn with you still in me. So we hugged, hooked legs, pooled trust, turned without him coming out at all. Christy, love fused our bodies hip to hip, arm in arm, lip to lip. Nothing else could fit. Christy, you're gone from me. I press my palms together without your clasped hands in between. I rub back blood into my hands until warm, when it should be your hand in my one dream that I rub the blood from and back into. No balm. Just our hands oils, finger by finger, down to the crinkly little bone that won't hold still when I press and rub against the cold. I clutch space and ache. I press hard. I bruise my own flesh and eat my own words. Since you've been gone, I've been beside myself. I saw a sun bloom in a sky and spore every color of a rainbow and felt bad because you weren't with me to see it grow. Your absence makes a razor of that sunrise dragged across my iris. I turn my back in such mornings for you as one would in something too strong to stomach to be any good, too good to be true. Then there are the dawns I don't see so much as hear. Voices sweet as dew, but I'm too busy searching such and such. A face moving across the sun-struck country to mind the birds as the sun makes its entry. I am stripped bare by the light, bare and lonely. My bones wrung clean, the clean bones ground to dust, scattered in the four winds, four deserts and four lakes. Four deserts and four lakes have opened between you and me. The two of us at opposite ends of a compass, poles apart like dusk and dawn, dark and light, black and white. Why couldn't we be either one or the other? Not both. Why fight two battles at once? How can we be in two places and be together? But in this place, at this time, every ounce of skin conspires against love. So gather, trade winds. Let the sky fill its lungs and peel off my skin. Leave just flesh and bones and me raceless like trees and stones. To slip this skin, shed it for something new that's no color on earth or in the sky. Raceless like light. And our love as lithe as a minnow on a river. And the river all the lighter for the blessing of a moon. The streets washed clean by dew, by light. The houses painted from pillar to post. The one color of love which is every color ever seen. I scrub, fetch, sew, wash, iron, put wet things out, take dry things off clotheslines, measure my days by the wrung, beaten light journeying across the floor in stripes, bars, wondering if your mind runs the same way. If you do the same chores, if you push wonder from your face like a lock of hair absently put behind your ear, but it won't stay there, falling in your blue eyes again. You're not with me, you're with someone. Somebody to call you, somebody to keep you warm, who says yes when you call love, darling, petal, woman. You've forgotten about me. I am less each day, I'm absent, less than my name. I did not mean your people to despise you for loving me. If I could rub off the black and be like you to be with you, I realize that I can't. I am black from head to toe, back and front, black gums, black cuticles, black eyes. You thought me beautiful, black made you ache for more black. So much black I turned blue, your white became black, and I became you. Christie studied his hands. First the front, can he read palms? A line near the thumb breaks into tributaries that run over the wrist but feed back to form a curved river or cut, burnt in flesh. Those lines disentangle and plunge between the index and middle finger. He flipped his hands over, the knuckles are gnarled, bruised, swollen. Tendons welded to the wrist stand in a bed of tall veins. His curled fingers form a huge hammer for a fist. He plants his feet and pounds a bag. Boxes shadows in his new life as pugilist. He fights at fairs and roams from country to town. He earns his bed and board. He bites his tongue. Between bouts, he checks each plantation on the pretext that he's scouting the area for new talent or better competition. His hammer hands always healing are a boxer's dream, hard and quick and numb, but he can't straighten his fingers or draw or write, since he can hardly hold a pen. His brain is numb. He sleeps with his eyes open. He tastes his own blood when he swallows and spits what may as well be saliva. A voice trapped deep inside him bellows when he sees a man his age who is a slaver. How he keeps his cool he doesn't know, but he arranges it so that man is another contestant to beat or be beaten by. Win or lose, Christie is the one who cries. You can tell he's crying. There's water spilling from the outermost corners of his eyes that were or weren't jabbed or butted. Whether he's sprawled in the ring or he defies gravity and is the last man standing. Victor or vanquished, the one who groans or sighs, he deals in fists for faith, his sole ally. His job shuts eyes and makes teeth fly. Africa in America. Catch a goat. Take a sharp blade, rub it against stone. Brace the goat and yourself and cut its throat. Drain the blood into calabash. Ignore the moan of ropey liquid against the gourd. Throw sand on the spot to prevent dogs homing in on that coagulating blood. Skin the carcass. Stretch the skin over wood for one purpose. It stinks and dries in an indirect sun. The meat is ready for a pot, dying to be cured, parceled out to family and friends. The horns ground into powder, then mixed into a puree with herbs. The feet for a broth. The scrotum is a delicacy. The tongue peppered for stew. The tail continues to whisk flies. The hooves walk mountainous clouds in the sky. Skin over wood, hollow wood, stretched skin. Hands talk to heart, boneless hands. A flood of understanding comes to that part of the wood beneath that stretched skin, about the good imbued by hands coming down smart on it, fluid fingers flowing above the skin, flattening it with touch talk, and it sings. A continent in sound. Sound brings a continent across the sky and sea. A continent shaped by hands on skin, sacrificed by a goat who must have seen his soul fluting not on a heady mountain ledge, but airborne, dragging this parachute free of its moorings, relocating an archipelago in sounds of souls no longer cargo. Until goat talked it down to the ground, coaxed it up through the soles of our feet into our chest and our head and our tongue. It is a lost, forgotten place, missing teeth worried by our tongue, something we long for, dream of, but won't know if we meet. The Africa we never got to know sprung in the America we reap and sow. Our heads spin with this posited place. Our skulls resonate with our captured past. It weighs our hearts, brimming all the spaces between with all the things we feel we've lost. Our flesh aches and only pains less when faced with drum talk. Drum bringing down the ghost of Africa from dreams, down through history and up, up, up through flesh and blood stories. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. You've been reading to us just now from Bloodlines, which is a novel in verse, which I think for many people is a bit of a sort of strange concept. Would you like to say something about the attractions of the four?
the
novel in verse.
Yeah. Well, it has a long tradition. It first came to my attention with Vikram Seth's book, The Golden Gate, written in sonnets, and loosely about California West Coast life style during the opulent 80s, Reagan years. Since then, there have been a number of verse novels, all of them, some tending towards fiction, as Vikram Seth does, driven by narrative and character much more than a sense of local delight in the form. And then you have the others that swing the other way, that seem to serve poetry better than narrative and character and event. Obviously, with history, I'd written a couple of novels about slavery, and I wanted to write one more, because someone said to me, "Why are you always writing about slavery, boy?" And I thought, okay, I'm going to write one more book. But I set myself the task of a very open historical period, a long period of time, and the challenge of a form that's very that's quite narrow in terms of what it does. The octava rima, 8 lines, stanza, roughly rhymed the first 6 lines, A, B, A, B, A, B, and then a closing couplet, C, C. I guess it encourages thought over an 8-line period. And because of those incessant rhymes, you're forced to go towards lightness. And that for me, as it was an interesting challenge with a heavy subject, to just, because I've been writing formal poetry for years and years, I wanted to take on something that was a formal engagement with pressing history.
I'm sure there are questions out there. Stunned silence. Yeah, David.
Oh, okay. Standing up. Yeah, okay. Maybe I was too far away from it.
Sorry, was everybody sort of missing that altogether? Oh, sorry about that. Could you summarize what you're just saying, yeah.
This water is fizzy, not flat. And I hope next time I can open a fizzy bottle. And then, no, I was asked about the verse novel. And I try to explain that the period of slavery is a wide open field. Octava rima, rima is a narrow path walking up and down that field. And that's why I took on the constriction of that verse form, because I thought there'd be some pressure between the two. I also know Don Juan by Byron is the best historical example of that form, a largely comic poem full of satirical urges and so on, with the occasional attempts at social satire and seriousness. I was interested in using the form much more to do something else. So I wrote that book. All right, waving hands.
Hi. You're writing this for Octava Rima, and it helps you think. You're saying you think of an 8-line period. How does that affect your passion, your original premise for writing the book? How did you actually, did you write it passionately? Did you write it quite coldly? How did you get the rhymes? How did writing that form affect?
Well, the form, because of the A, B, A, B, A, B, C, C form, it tends towards humor. The catchphrase couplet at the end, 6 lines setting something up. It's a classic comic form. And so a lot of my thinking was trying to get over the rhymes as quietly as possible. And for the pressure of event and narrative and character to overwhelm a listener who might be hearing the beats and thinking about rhyme. The other thing I was interested in too was in Byron, he does some great things. He rhymes intellectual with catch you all and so on. So even in his day, he was trying to take the rhyme and make it and stretch its credulity to break out of the confines of it and to play with that form. So I thought, given the advance of modernity, the least I could do is have sight rhymes and rhymes that you only have to hear if you have 3 rum and cokes and you come from, you know, the hills of Jamaica. Then you'd understand it was a rhyme. If you didn't, you couldn't see it. You'd think, how can these things sound? How does this word sound like this? Unfortunately, that invited a lot of criticism from reviewers who said they couldn't hear the form in Wiltshire being obeyed. But for me, I wasn't going to be confined by it. And if anybody looks back at the I've always written formal poems in the middle of the books. So I was keen to say, I've done that apprenticeship. I can do something else with form. And if people think I had a bad ear or I couldn't rhyme, they're missing the point. Does that answer your question a bit? Okay. If you lift your hand to take a drink, I'll assume you want to ask a question. It's like bidding. If you go like that, I'll say, yeah. Someone over there. The Christian symbolism of the names is, of course, intentional. And the other thing that you said about the gender bending and so on, what, did it work for you? if it did, the reader is always right. It was, of course, intentional. Actually, no, let me say a bit more. It's clear in the book, but I think I pulled bits out of it. And so maybe the bits in between will illustrate clearly who they are and where they're coming from. Yeah. Yes. 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 It was, yeah.
You mentioned Byron a few times. Was it a case of consciously
imitating Byron? No. I've been writing poetry since in my early 20s, seriously. And I've read the canons, and every poet has conversations book by book with elements in the canon and the anti-canon, whatever they're doing. So obviously, as a student of English literature and a poet, I wanted to both walk through forms and try and break them up and be less reverential with them. But imitation is interesting. I mean, obviously, it's a book about slavery. It's miles away from Byron's book, for starters. So I wanted to defy the comparison by taking on something on an opposite pole to him. It begins seriously. When it opens, it's clearly not going to be satirical. So I wanted to declare a different mood in that form at the outset. So I think I did three or four things deliberately to show a disengagement from Byron, but an engagement with the form when brought to bear on a very wide historical canvas. And I think that I made that clear in the poem. And I think also because I've been writing in and out of form and paying attention, I live and work in the States right now, where they have a number of poetries over a contested geography, as the language goes, and their formal elements and their free-form language elements that I've been reading across for the last few years. And I wanted to go back to a formal poem, because I just finished doing Bill of Rights, which you heard bits of, which is much more open, sing-songy, and a more various field. So having done Bill of Rights, a more open book, I wanted to close it down a bit in the next book of poems. In between that, there was a novel. So obviously I'm in conversation with myself as a writer, trying to develop and reflect change. So I hope that answers your question from Anglesey.
How does writing begin? Do you wait 2 hours for a very fixed, firm idea in your head? Or you just sit down and just see what comes out?
It can start with a challenge from a reader during a book signing when they say to me, when are you going to stop writing slave novels? And so I think, okay, I'm going to write another one. Or someone might say something like, you've been in America for so long, how come you don't write about it? Or you've been away from England, you're no longer British. In which case I start to re-engage and write about it. Or it's in a number of ways. I keep diaries, or notebooks as they're called, where I jot things down. I have plans for certain things that I want to do in the future, which may or may not happen. So it's a combination of feeling my way through things, sentences by, you know, phrase by phrase, and not knowing where it's going to go. Bloodlines was like that. Each eight-line bit, I thought, oh, great, I'll stop here. Then the next day, something else would happen, or else somebody was in a room and had to leave that room, and it took 24 lines to get them out the door, in which case I knew I'd have 24 lines to write before lunch or something. So it didn't happen. I had no lunch. So there are a number of ways to approach that. People work differently. For me, I don't have a plan that I then write to. I tend to work. I'm not sure where I'm going to end up, but although I have a clear starting phrase or a starting image. In this case, it was the narrator for Bloodlines was going to die when there was peace and the races got along. And that gave me a chance to think about what the last century has been in terms of history, the history of people of color. Because W.B. Du Bois did open the 20th century with a statement that he felt the 20th century would be about the color line, the major problem of the 20th century. Of course, it was several things, but I thought that would be an interesting premise to look at, that to see if that held up. So there are a lot of things buried in the book that I don't want to reveal too much about that got me going and made me stay with the idea of it. Some are formal and some are more to do with ideas and politics. There was a hand at the back of it.
What was the first thought
when you heard slave narratives? I've written a number of things, I should say. I don't just write slave narratives, but... But I've done a few now, so it's a fair question. Back in 80, my first book, Mamadot, was I wrote a poem when my grandmother died. That was based on Solomon Grundy, and I kind of emptied the rhythm out of the rhythm of its words and put my own words in. So it went something like, "Born on a Sunday in the kingdom of Ashanti, sold on Monday into slavery. Ran away on Tuesday 'cause she born free. Lost a foot on Wednesday when they catch she." And that narrative took her back in time beyond the limits of her body, and she became a bit larger than life. Now, that impulse was with me from way back to write my way through slavery. Walcott said each generation has his angst, but we has none, in that wonderful Creole inversion. But I think what he meant by that is that each generation would also have to revisit certain sites to interpret it in their own way. And I think that was my feeling about slavery. Having read Toni Morrison's wonderful book as well, Beloved, I felt there were ways to go walk through that that could be different for me later on writing fiction. But certainly in the poetry, I was always interested in a history that would update itself, but first of all, having to walk through that past. The image I also have from Walcott is in a poem of his where he has somebody rowing, and the guy who's rowing in a boat is rowing into the future with his eyes firmly on the past, and that Walcott, that image in Walcott is clearly saying that you can't go forward unless you know where you're coming from. Bob Marley says the same thing much more elegantly, I'm sure. But just the notion that you have to know your past to go forward, it is a notion that I think many writers have written their way through that, especially black writers who are kind of of my generation in England, who kind of are forced to think about blackness not as black beauty or, I don't know, positive, but when they were first called a bad name on a high street at 11:15 at night, or even in the morning, and they had to think, "What? You know, my skin attracts a really strange static. Why?" Well, find out. So you move back in time. I think those things were forced on me from spending 20 years in England during the 70s and 80s in South London, mostly. Well, my personal that's a good question, the personal experience. Well, I was politicized, not because I did a politics at school or had a political scientist who talked to me. It happened with incidents on the street and with talking to friends, and, you know, I became interested at a very young age in politics, especially in my teens, directly from having to come to terms with being black in London in the 70s. That's the first thing. The second thing is, speaking to other poets who've been writing, that personal experience becomes politicizes your body unintentionally. You don't want to be political. After all, the 70s was, I've said it before, but the 70s was full of, it was an era of disco. People were dancing and the night away and leaving their minds and their consciences at home, buried somewhere. Alongside that very 70s, there was, for me, a very different experience of London that made me forced me to think about why I was there and what was happening. That personal politics, then I then chased it up with facts and figures and spoke to people and read things and so on and learned about it. But it began with a name or two. Somebody there.
It's a question that has asked me. I don't think you won't write that. Not just for the purposes of publishing, but you know, I don't think you will think about it. And you know, so there's something you will not write a poem or something.
I think, excuse me, say a bit more, I didn't quite...
Well, are there subjects...
Subjects.
Subjects, yeah, or... Yeah, or things that you respond to...
If someone calls me nigger, I respond. I try to chase them and catch them. I get angry. I'm outraged by that experience in Britain. That moved me to think and write political poems. British Subjects... It's full of poems about skin, about the nature of it inhabiting skin that is a negative static in a landscape. A mixture of things. When I celebrate, I write celebratory things in a good mood. I vary. But the enduring subject for me, obviously, is contemporary British history. I'm intrigued by it. I'm intrigued by what's happening to the British Isles and how they're having to take on board the presence of blackness. And I think that is Britain's most challenging aspect of its modernity. It tests its civilized mode if it can't cope with a few hundred thousand black people. What kind of an island is this? Well, so I'm interested in that. I'm interested in civilization and, you know, notions of being civilized, what that means when it comes to being humanitarian, both about the distribution of wealth, you know, the 1784 problem, and about the other in your landscape. How do you cope with that? And about the return to that mainstream by that minority when they start to talk about the place with love. For example, English landscape. And, you know, I think it's wonderful. I love parts of this country with passion, with a passion. Now, no one can take that away from me. And I've got to square that love with some negative experiences that have painted that landscape with blood. And some pitched battles in parts of South London and other inner city areas. That's the reality. And that generates for me a lot of poetry. And those poems, I think, I hope, are speaking on behalf of that Britishness and trying to alter it. And it's a generation-by-generation battle, decade-by-decade battle. I know it is a decade-by-decade battle because things I thought were over in the 80s that I'd fought and talked to writers about then have recurred now with the newer writers talking about it all over again. Because just as we convert and make certain people hear us in certain ways, they have to convert a new generation of people who are deaf to those very issues and have to relearn it again and be told about it. So I think it's going to happen that there's no incremental progress, but there are conversations that recur again and again with different nuances that have to be calibrated, fine-tuned by those, by the various people who take them on as issues.
It's actually related to what you said about conflict between you and the England. But when you're thinking of writing poetry and actually written poems, what's the first thing that you have with the poems you have in that book?
Okay, well, yeah. Some poems take about 20 minutes, if I'm lucky. If all the stars are aligned properly in the sky, I will wake up in the morning with a dream or a phrase, and 20 minutes later, I will have something that's roughly finished. In other words, I take words out and put the same words back in, and no, I've got to walk away from it. That's rare. Mostly, they're drafts of things. These days, I spend a lot of time writing against a romantic impulse in my body. at university and before, I read, you know, Shelley and Keats, Wordsworth, and loved them with a passion, Blake. And so, kind of venerate and love landscape. I said, and what I try to do these days when I write that veneration and that romanticism, I then try and muddy the water of it. Or I try to vandalize it with an ugly political idea. And I'm interested in poetry, if the poetry can take that pressure. So that, these days I spend a lot of time undoing my poems by throwing something in there because, you know, it's too articulate. It doesn't stutter enough. It's too sensuous and succulent with place. It needs to be a bit more unsettled. It might be being middle-aged too. I've kind of hit, I was 40 the other week. Depressing. Once you hit that, you start to, you know, think differently about time. You look back on what you've done. I get a lot of emails from people who remind me of things I've already done. Why am I doing it again? So I try and do it one more time. Stuff like that. You know, I have conversations going on all kinds of levels that are playful but also serious. Living in the States too have forced me to think again about writing out of England and now writing in a third landscape, and the idea of a kind of triple heritage, not just dual. I mean, Bloodlines begins with the idea of twins and goes to a third place. And I'm trying to get a coalition between those three places to see what comes out of it. And that coalition's in my head, of course, and my heart, my body. It's not a real place, but it's real in the book. Trying to get, obviously, beyond race to a complex idea of the traveler, the fortunate traveler, as Derek Walcott would have it. Some idea that will praise the voice, some sort of idea that will put song back into the middle of utterance. A little, some idea about the line that you read, the muscle of the eyes moving to a line that's broken before the margin, the joy of that, the sensuous delight of that, the conversation of that. Homage to the book as a living thing there that, you know, talks back to you. All those things are things I'm engaging with, yeah.
No.
I never know the end until I get to the end. And although I do sometimes shuffle things, if I write something and it's in the middle and buried in the book, in revision I might move it up a bit. The example is in The Longest Memory, the first line, which is what? Oh, yes. The future is more of the past. The future is, thank you very much, the future is just more of the past waiting to happen. It was a line that was buried in the story of Whitechapel, the old slave sinking. And I thought it was too good to have it in the middle of the book, so I took it out and placed it in various places until it got to the very front of the book. And that's a bit corrupt, but I thought it was a good way to... It declared its intention, the book's intention about time, memory, etc., etc. So that was one example where revision altered the kind of natural way in which the text unfolded. There's a lot of that happens with my revision. I shuffle things around. I'm sure every writer does that too. They move things around for effect, chop things out. Revision is partly the art of contraction, but sometimes because it's poetry, which is simultaneously a kind of compression of language, but an expansion of meaning. Because that's happening, you sometimes have to... Well, you add sometimes to. No, go ahead, yes, sorry. The Longest Memory was made by Channel 4, then put into a cupboard for about 11 months, and then eventually shown at an hour when nobody was awake.
So you're then happy about it?
Say no more. But I like the idea of collaboration. The most interesting thing making the film was making it at Elstree Studios. And we couldn't film because there were some pigeons in one of the big warehouses, which was one of the sets. And they were on the rack, and they kept swooping around, and the cameras couldn't roll. And they kept opening the doors and trying to encourage them to go out by shouting things at them. They still didn't move. Then they have somebody I didn't even know existed at L3 Studios. He has a gun, and he shoots pigeons that hold up filming. He turned up and started to put his equipment together very slowly. And we were all saying, oh God, it mustn't come to this. We're shooting the pigeons, begging them to come out, throwing seeds in the air, and so on. And he looks through his sight and he added bits to it. And when he took aim, well, the last time he's about to shoot, we closed the doors and opened them again with a flourish one more time. And a lot of light came pouring in. It was a very gray English day. The clouds moved away. A lot of sunlight came pouring in. And all the pigeons in one movement swooped down from the ledge and went straight out the warehouse. The guy put his gun away very slowly.
Bill of Rights talked about durability of poetry. I'm just wondering where you think the world can stand in the politics of the text can stand in maybe 500 years' time.
It's going to be in the web somewhere, I assume. It'll be lying down on the web. I have no idea about posterity. One never thinks about posterity. What you think about is the next bill, the next commission, the next person you're arguing with because you're writing a book that is trying to answer something or is talking back to something. Those are the conversations I'm interested in. Posterity, I don't give a tosh about it. I think it's a load of bollocks.
Yes, what has posterity ever done for us?
Is that a fair answer?
Well, in Bergman's character, Ron Blyth raises.
Yes, you're right. I mean, obviously, the future is somebody else's concern, not mine. What I'm concerned about is the past. And Bloodlines is all about what's just happened to us a century. And is blackness a test of time in a landscape? If we were to pressurize it, will it give us answers? And why is blackness constructed the way it is these days? Mostly negative, tied to slavery, etc. That was my thing about that. The color line that W.E.B. Du Bois mentions, I was interested in that. So it's mainly a concern with the past rather than posterity or the future. It's also because the present, which is obviously full of questions, is the only way you can deal with it is you can look around you and try and get ready answers to the phenomena of the present, but I think the present is best served by looking back. That rowing figure in the Walcott poem who's looking backwards and rowing forwards is for me an enduring poetic notion about what the figure of the artist is, historically aware, and not static, as Elizabeth Bishop said in At the Fish Houses. Now, what is she saying? I'm not very good at quoting because I just got out of a car. What's the relationship between quoting and being in a car? Because knowledge, she says at the very end of At the Fish Houses, knowledge is historical, flowing and flown. I think were the last phrases she had there. And I thought about the idea of, as an artist, the notion of history as knowledge. For a poet like Elizabeth Bishop, who is a quintessentially sensuous, descriptive writer, or is perceived as such, declaring in this poem an historical imagination. So, I love America. I love America because I have a job. So it's a very selfish love. Then, it's a job that I couldn't get over here in England, teaching creative writing full-time, working 2.5 days a week. The rest of the time, being attached to a library, it's a joy. So I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for any globalized system that gives me that job, even if they're pernicious. Now, having said that, obviously I think about where I am and what's going on around me. So yes, what you describe is true. It's horrific. But those horrors, by the way, are here. I mean, Stephen Lawrence was the big test case, the celebrated case over here. Someone set upon by five people, stabbed to death. Bleeds to death in the street. Dead at 18. Now, all across the American landscape, those incidents are happening too. But by the time Lawrence became famous here, I'd grown up with that having happened. We had lists of blacks who were killed in police cells by the police, or in the back of vans in a chokehold. So Britain for me was a brutalized landscape. I had no romantic notions about it. Had they given me a job, I might be talking about the place differently. I'd be saying, I'm grateful to this university, and then, but, these things have happened. So I think you have to square a kind of body and soul reality with a political consciousness that is then, you have to deal with, and the reality of that. Obviously America is what it is. That's why I'm writing slave novels, trying to get that past to speak to an American present, a British present, a European present, Caribbean present. I mean, Paul Gilroy has talked about the Black Atlantic and the ship and the sea joining these places and the movement of Ja people, as it were, globally. You have to add to that, of course, indentureship. But I think the enduring image is maybe, it's not even a ship, actually, it's an airplane. Speaking to black writers who have moved and keep moving, for us, the Black Atlantic is actually probably a skyscraper. The image isn't a ship, it's an airplane. It isn't the sea anymore, it's the sky. And that's a different kind of account. That account isn't theorized very well, but certainly there are texts in which you can find it being talked about in stories. I tried it in Bill of Rights to talk about that notion by having, well, I can't explain it, but it's in this, read, have a look at it if you have a chance. Bloodlines tries to take it on. There are a number of writers who are writing this now, not writing the sky, but revising Gilroy's Black Atlantic. Not because they just heard about it from him, but because for them it was more than a ship, it was more than a sea joining things. It was always modernity for them. And for us, is there are different emblems and ways of talking about it.
Well, I think we could take one more question.
Fred, so if you were to have your job here, are you going back to
Britain? Tomorrow. Show me the money. No, I don't mean that. Show me the politics, of course, politics. Oh, yes. Can I borrow Bloodlines one more time? I mean, Bill of Rights, you see, okay. It's a poem about England in the middle of this book. Where's the middle? So you gotta give me a second to find it. Oh, here we are. Yes. No. Oh, yes. We had the notion that we'd walk from Land's End to John O'Groats, collecting signatures for a Bill of Rights in our black and blue yacht inns, collect enough names to lay from one end of that land to the other. Then, and only then, we'd hang up those shoes, what's left of them. That, or never sing Marley, Burning Spear, Tapazuki, as long as we drew English air. Over a banana skin climate, over an orange peel land, over a blood orange history, over a star apple kingdom, over a pear-shaped people, over a kiwi fruit territory, over a coconut husk accent, over a Granny Smith culture, over green turnip weather, over a courgette drama, over an aubergine theatre, over the potato moors, over a split pea valley, over a channa wall, over a grits seawall, over a black-eyed pea sea, over a sago moon, over a penny farthing lake, over a runner bean stream, over banger and mash hills, over a savory and chips midlands, over a vinegar rain, over a blowtorch sun, over a ketchup sun, over a stethoscope wind, over a sewer wind, over a telescoped island, over a microscope island, over a shrink-wrapped island, over a gobsmacked island, over a I-O-U-nothing island.